Thank you very much. Now, I must warn you that I will probably repeat at the beginning one or two things I've said before. And those who have heard them, please be patient at hearing them again. But we just consider how the Winter's Tale fits in with the other plays chronologically. When Shakespeare was 30, these dates are not absolutely certain, but when he was about 30, he wrote Midsummer Night's Dream and the next year Romeo and Juliet. And those were wonderful anticipations. I mean, far greater, to my mind, than the other plays that he wrote at the same time. Wonderful anticipations of what was to come. And it was 7 years after Romeo and Juliet that he wrote, the age of 38, that he wrote Hamlet. And it was nearly 10 years after that that he wrote The Winter's Tale. I suppose it was about 6 years before his death then. Now, as you know, the 16th century was like a great river swelled by the river of Christian mysticism, swelled by tributaries of Pythagoreanism, Platonism, Kabbalism, Hermetism, and a great many other things. And these doctrines were fascinating to the dramatists of Shakespeare's time and to their patrons, the aristocrats who were their patrons. There's no doubt about that. And so it is not surprising that there should be in Shakespeare's plays a very strong mystical element. But the play we have tonight, I would say, is Shakespeare's explicitly most mystical play. Now, just a word on mysticism. One can say that the essential which Shakespeare took from his day, and he is at heart a medieval rather than a man of the Renaissance, is the question of the fall of man, the loss of paradise, the possibility of return. All mysticism is concerned with this. Firstly, with the coming to know of one's faults. That corresponds to Dante's Inferno, the descent into hell. Secondly, purification from the faults, and death of the old fallen soul, which is reborn in the primordial perfection. And what I've just mentioned was known in antiquity as parva mysteria. I'm speaking of the Greco-Roman antiquity, the lesser mysteries. The greater mysteries are the mystical union of the perfect soul with the divine spirit. Dante's epic comprises both mysteries. But Shakespeare probably did not know the Divine Comedy. He certainly must have known of it. And in any case, epic and drama are poles apart as forms. And since Brian spoke about the perennial philosophy, I will just point out that mysticism is in all religious forms very much the same, despite wide outward differences in the different religions, in the exoteric aspects of the religions. Inwardly, they are always in close mutual harmony that merges into identity inasmuch as they all lead to the one truth. Now, when one speaks of the mysteries, one thinks, first of all, of what the Greeks call the Eleusinian mysteries. And it is generally known that there has to be always an initiation into the mysteries. And this initiation is universally described as the grafting of a shoot of the primordial nature into the old stock of man's fallen nature. And the initiate thus acquires a new ancestry. And initiation is thus likened to a second birth. As I pointed out in a previous talk, when Hamlet affirms the necessity of initiation in order to overcome man's fallen nature, he says in a typically Hamletian way, "Virtue cannot so inoculate our old stock, but we shall relish of it." This is not noticed by most readers of Hamlet because the language is rather archaic and difficult. But it means that the plight of fallen man calls for nothing less than the inoculation of our old stock with a new nature, which would transform it and take away its evil stench, which a few virtues plastered over the surface could not do. By way of a parallel, the Arabic word talqin, which means inoculation or grafting, the same agricultural simile, is regularly used in Sufism in the sense of initiation. And this same image is to be found all over the world. Now, the newly acquired primordial ancestry in question is the chain of succession which every mystical order has and which is a guarantee of the order's authenticity, a chain going back from master to master throughout the generations as far as the founder of the mystical form in question. It is for the initiate to cherish the new shoot and to prevent the old stock from putting out suckers. I'm continuing to use the imagery in question of grafting. The powers of darkness, which have the old stock still under their sway, will do all they can to make it stifle the primordial graft with suckers of fallen nature. But the initiate has at his disposal invincible weapons with which, if he remains faithful to his vows, he can enable the graft to flourish and grow to fullness. That fullness marks the end of the lesser mysteries. Now, in sacred art, since the mysteries, lesser and greater, together make up the whole way, which ends with the beatific union of the perfected and transfigured soul with the divine spirit. Initiation into the mysteries is often represented by marriage. So it is in Shakespeare, wherever the symbolism of love predominates. But since at the beginning of the path, the initiation is still only virtual and has to be actualized by the efforts of the initiate, the marriage in question must have a certain lack of fullness. Romeo and Juliet are never really at peace together till they lie buried in the same tomb. Much the same applies to Othello and Desdemona. In Cymbeline, Posthumus is banished as soon as he has married Imogen. In Antony and Cleopatra, it is the actual legal marriage that is lacking. With her dying words, having had the courage to take her own life in order to join Antony in Elysium, Cleopatra says, "Husband, I come. Now to that name my courage prove my title." That is, to the name of husband, may my courage prove my right. In our play, which we're considering tonight, the shortcoming of the marriage is more subtle and psychological, as we shall see, being bound up with the faults that the initiate has to overcome. Our play also differs in another respect from many of the others. An aspect of its simplicity is that there is no mutual deification from lover to beloved. I say mutual deification, that is important. Whereas in Romeo and Juliet, Antony and Cleopatra, with Posthumus and Imogen and Ferdinand and Miranda in The Tempest, each lover looks on the other as a god. This is in the nature of things, because all esotericism is based on the secret that every human being has a divine nature underlying the human nature. The eye of love has power to pierce through the human nature of the beloved to its divine archetype. In all true love, there is an element of worship. Thus, to quote Romeo, "But soft, what light from yonder window breaks? It is the east, and Juliet is the sun. And she is shortly to say to him, when he asks what he shall swear by to convince her that he loves her, 'Do not swear at all, but if thou wilt, swear by thy gentle self, which is the god of my idolatry, and I'll believe you.'" So it is also with Antony and Cleopatra, with Posthumus and Imogen, with Ferdinand and Miranda. But in The Winter's Tale, as in Othello, the relationship is not reversed. Hermione, like Desdemona, is divine. Leontes, like Othello, is the initiate on his way to perfection, which their respective wives already have. The same applies, of course, to Cordelia in King Lear, though the love relationship here is not conjugal. Of all Shakespeare's greatest plays, The Winter's Tale is the simplest and the shortest. Hamlet is almost twice the length. And The Winter's Tale is also, as I have just said, the most explicitly mystical. Now, I wonder if somebody could put a clock here, because I want to have some idea of what the time is, because I don't know, I mustn't leave out important things, and I have quite a lot to say. Thank you very much.
You'd like to go on and say them, even if you go over now.
Well, I might go over now. I may be short, maybe over too soon. I can't tell. I don't.
You know what they say, Pesh? From the beginning to the end, time belongs to the supreme.
Well, I will not leave anything out, hopefully, of importance. I will leave a lot out of importance, I'm sorry, inevitably, because the subject is tremendous, and of course one can't do justice to it. Now the play begins at the close of a visit of Polixenes, king of Bohemia, to Leontes, king of Sicilia. I suppose most of you have read the play, but I will, and forgive my reminding you of it, but it's necessary to do so, really, in view of what I want to say. It opens with a short scene, somewhat ironical, between a Sicilian lord and a Bohemian lord, and their main theme is the great love that the two kings bear each other. And the next scene is a room of state in the palace, and the two kings are there with Queen Hermione, the wife of Leontes, and their young son, Prince Mamilius. And Leontes is trying to persuade his royal guest to stay longer, but Polixenes says it is imperative that he should return to Bohemia. Again, Leontes begs him to stay. Again, he refuses. Then Leontes blames his wife for being silent and tells her to plead with their guest to stay. She succeeds where he had failed. Polixenes agrees to stay. And suddenly a wave of raging jealousy sweeps over Leontes. He looks at his son and says, "Art thou my boy?" But on that score, he is reassured by the prince's resemblance to himself. But only on that score is he reassured. He tells his wife, he speaks in asides, of course. The audience know what he is thinking because he speaks in asides. Polixenes and Hermione don't hear what he is saying. But he tells them to walk in the garden. He tells his wife to walk in the garden with Polixenes. And he tells the prince to go away and play. And then he turns to Camillo, his right-hand man, and tells him what he suspects, or rather what he knows, for his suspicion has become conviction. Camillo vehemently refutes him, protesting that both Hermione and Polixenes are purely innocent. Leontes will not listen. He orders Camillo to poison Polixenes. At this point, it must be noted that there are no villains in the play at all, except for a dishonest rogue who appears in the last part of the play briefly, but who has no connection with the plot, or Tylacus. The characters stand round like guardian angels while the evil works its way out of the soul of the protagonist. Camillo feels sure that Leontes will repent, but meantime something has to be done. He agrees to poison Polixenes, but instead goes and explains to Polixenes the whole situation, organizing his immediate escape from Sicilia, and he accompanies him himself to Bohemia. In the next scene, Hermione is with her ladies and the prince. She asks her son to tell her a story. She knows nothing about what has been happening in Leontes' mind. "Merry or sad shalt be," he says. "As merry as you will," she replies. But he says, "A sad tale's best for winter." Hence the name of the play. And as he begins the tale, Leontes rushes madly into the room. He has just heard of Polixenes' flight with Camillo, and that has for him altogether confirmed his conviction. The queen is shortly to give birth to a child. He tells her that Polixenes is its father and orders the guards to take her to prison. As she goes with her women, she says to him, "Adieu, my lord. I never wished to see you sorry. Now I trust I shall." The lords who are present all protest vigorously, but to no avail, except that Leontes says, "Yet, for a greater confirmation, I have dispatched to sacred Delphos, to Apollo's temple, Cleomenes and Dion. Now from the oracle they will bring all. Though I am satisfied and need no more than what I know, yet shall the oracle give rest to the minds of others." Meantime, in prison, Hermione gives birth to a girl. Paulina, one of the ladies of the court, takes the babe to Leontes, thinking it will soften his heart. He orders Paulina's husband Antigonus to burn it. Antigonus pleads for its life. The king agrees not to have it burnt on condition that Antigonus will take it to some desert place outside Sicilia and leave it to the mercies of nature. Antigonus sadly agrees to this better of two evils. In this same scene, we learn that the prince has pined into sickness through not being allowed to see his mother. Then we see the priest-like Cleomenes and Dion, who have just returned with a sealed document from the oracle. In the play, incidentally, this is of no importance, but there is a slight geographic confusion between Delos, the island where Apollo was born, and Delphi, which is not an island, the place of the oracle. In the play, they speak of the island of Delphos. But it is a mistake which comes to Shakespeare through Pandosto, Green's romance, which provided the source of this play. In this little scene, Shakespeare is at pains to impress on us, through them, through Cleomenes and Dion, the tremendous sanctity of Apollo's shrine. We are really in the ancient world. Apollo is, for Shakespeare in this play, the manifestation of the divine word. As I said elsewhere, for Shakespeare, as for Dante, Apollo is not the god of light, but the light of God. Then follows the trial scene. By this time, Leontes has added to the accusation that she, Hermione, and Camillo were plotting his death, in addition to the other accusations. The accusation is read out. Hermione makes two moving speeches in her defense. And then finally, she appeals to the oracle. Apollo, be my judge. Leontes orders the seals to be broken. The oracle is read out. Hermione is chaste. Polixenes blameless. Camillo a true subject. Leontes, a jealous tyrant, his innocent babe truly begotten, and the king shall live without an heir if that which is lost be not found. Everyone in the court, except Leontes, cries out, "Now blessed be the great Apollo." Leontes says, "Hast thou read truth?" to the man who was reading, the officer who was reading the oracle. "Aye, my lord, even so as it is here set down." And Leontes cries out, "There is no truth at all in the oracle. The session shall proceed. This is mere falsehood." Immediately a servant enters with the news that the prince is dead. And Leontes is utterly shattered. Hermione faints. And he begs Paulina to tend her. Apollo's angry, and the heavens themselves do strike at my injustice. And then he prays for forgiveness. Apollo, pardon my great profaneness against thine oracle. I'll reconcile me to Polixenes, new woo my queen, recall the good Camillo. And then he goes on to praise the excellence of Camillo's behavior in the impossible circumstances in which Camillo was placed. Then Paulina returns with the news that Hermione is dead. And Leontes vows to mourn his wife and son for the rest of his life. Come and lead me to these sorrows, is the end of the scene. And the next scene is on the shores of Bohemia. Antigonus tells how he saw Hermione in a dream, and she told him to call the babe whom he has brought with him to these shores, told him to call the babe Perdita. Perdita means she who is lost. He puts the child down with a mantle belonging to her mother, and a letter saying who she is, also some gold coins. Then he goes back to join his ship, but on the way he is killed by a bear and the ship is wrecked and everybody is drowned. A shepherd finds the babe and takes it home, but first he and his son go to bury the remains of Antigonus, whose death, as well as the shipwreck, the son has witnessed. His father says to him, "Thou mettest with things dying, I with things newborn." This is the turning point of the play. To make a parallel with Dante's epic, we see that the whole of the first three acts correspond to the descent into hell, the coming to know of the worst possibilities that lurk unseen in fallen souls. The bottom of hell has been reached with the worst sin of all, that of blasphemy. And Leontes, having recanted, enters into purgatory.